Just getting your vehicle ready for driving can take a bit longer than usual in these cold days of winter, but some of the things we use to associate with winter car care are no longer necessary in this age of onboard control computers. So let's talk about winter car care and issues. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive. He's our partner in a monthly segment we call The Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel. Give us a call or email to talk about automotive issues you have had or are currently having. Again, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Zach, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks, Jeff.
So is there anything in particular? I mean, cars, for one thing, don't seem to need to warm up as long as they used to. I remember, you know, back in the days of everything with carburetors and no fuel injection, it seemed like you had to let the car run for about half an hour on super cold days to get it going up to its full strength.
Yeah, definitely. The intention of modern strategy with fuel delivery is to get the car to warm up as quickly as possible. So every manufacturer has that intention because, of course, the government regulates fuel economy standards, and all the manufacturers are trying to meet that. And so the more quickly a car can warm up, the more quickly the fuel management can go into a lean mode, which means, you know, less fuel in the air-fuel ratio. And the ideal ratio is 14.7 parts air to one part fuel. And so if you're in an enrichment mode, that would maybe be a, you know, 10 to 1 or a 11 to 1. I'm not sure about the details of that, but it's, you know, it's going to be in what's called a enrichment mode. And the sooner you can get your car warmed up, the sooner it's going to get to 14.7 to 1.
But here again, it's the computer that's controlling all this. Isn't that like, you know, the old days of choke stops and all that stuff?
Absolutely. With carburetors, that was just a guess. It was, the carburetor would add fuel based off of the Venturi principle, which was, you know, air flowing past a fuel jet, and it would suck in an approximate amount of fuel. But it was very, it was scientific, but not nearly as controlled as the modern methods can do.
So much, much finer control. It's like the fine tuning now of your car, basically going on from a computer while it's happening.
Yep, absolutely.
So I remember in the past you had said 30 seconds is really about all any modern car needs for a warm up on a winter day. Is that the case?
Yeah, 30 seconds to a minute. Mm-hmm. If you could do that every day, that would be really good. You know, the most damage done to an engine happens in the first 30 seconds to 1 minute of driving. And so if you're not actually driving during that time, the car is just idling, that would be ideal. And I actually just read an article recently about any warm-up longer than a minute could actually have negative effects on the car because of fuel washing the oil off of the walls of the cylinder. It takes quite a while to warm up your car if it's idling versus driving down the road. And mm-hmm. So really the 1 minute warm-up time is a nice medium in between mm-hmm. excessive idling and just jumping in your car and taking off down the road.
Oh, I see. So it's an actual load set of conditions that's going to provide the real engine to warm up if it's actually having to function to push the car around.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. I have to admit, you know, on a day like today, this is unusual, though, in the Rogue Valley, where we get a case where it rains and then it clears up and then things freeze right after that. So I was, first of all, concerned I wasn't going to get in the car this morning. That has happened before. We have to tug on the door handle and finally the molding gives way. And I'm always afraid the rubber's going to go. But I did warm up my car a little longer this morning just to get the defroster to help me scrape it. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these days you get the car just seems like it's covered with ice and you're scraping ice off ice.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, older cars, we know you drive a carbureted car, right?
it's a 98, is it carbureted?
older cars definitely take longer to warm up. The thermostats in those cars might not be of the modern design. So when I talk about modern design, the thermostats of the modern era, they open and close a lot, where older thermostats were sometimes just open or closed. And if your thermostat's old, it might be in a state of failing or failure, but not be completely failed. And so it really shouldn't take, you know, on my old truck, I think of a 97 Toyota truck, that my heat starts to get hot and my gauge starts to come up after just maybe 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty normal. It's got a fairly new thermostat in it. But if it's taking a real long time for your car to warm up, the thermostat could be stuck open, which means the coolant or the antifreeze, which is the same term, is flowing through the radiator upon initial startup when it really shouldn't be. Upon initial startup, that the radiator should be closed off of the system and the coolant should just be sitting in the water jackets.
Around the cylinders themselves, because you want them to heat up fast.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a closed loop there. And then all the heat generated from the friction of the internal moving parts of the engine then gets absorbed by the coolant as it's lying in wait kind of around those cylinders. And then once everything starts to warm up to a certain temperature, then the thermostat opens. And, you know, you're talking thermostat's going to open at maybe 160 or 170 degrees and allow that cooling to take place and try and keep the temperature of that engine around 200 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Zach Edwards, our guest on this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel. We're talking about winter car care, but anything really under the hood or elsewhere on the car is fair game. Join us at 800-838-3760 with your phone calls. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Karen in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on The Squeaky Wheel.
Yes, I just wanted to mention, in case other people don't know this, I had the check engine light, and like everybody, I kind of ignored it for a while, quite a while, and figuring it was an oxygen sensor. Well, then about 2 months ago, it started blinking, and I thought, well, that's odd. I don't think I've ever heard of one blinking. But again, I was busy and didn't get in. So I took my car in yesterday. And I have a burnt valve. He says that the valve's tightened down over time. And if I'd have come in right away when it started blinking, I probably would have saved a burnt valve and a bunch of money.
All right. So burnt valve, are you familiar?
Yeah, that's spot on. And I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm sorry that happened to you because I know that that's going to be an expensive repair. But the check engine light has really three modes. It can come on and then turn itself off. It can come on and stay on, or it can flash. And once it becomes a flashing check engine light, that signifies that there's a problem happening, which could cause catastrophic damage to your engine or other, you know, perhaps the transmission. And so once it's flashing, it's actually already pretty bad, and if you ignore it, ignore a flashing light for any period of time, even, you know, a day or two, it could be too late, and that's why, you know, the importance of not ignoring your check engine light is that light should be significant, and if the light is on all the time, the significance is lost. You might not notice as a driver that the car is driving any differently, but there's definitely a problem. And the whole point of that light is, you know, the governmental side of things is to reduce hydrocarbon emissions. But to the driver, to the end user, it really should be a moment of significance where something's wrong. I need to get this thing to the shop as soon as I can. And no, you don't need to rush to the shop immediately, though lots of people do. And those are the people that I think protect their engines the best and don't have unnecessary repairs. But if you ignore that light, something else might be going on, which could cause you to break down and you'll never know. So there could be more than one problem under there, but you only have one light.
Right, and of course one engine too, and you want to make sure you take care of that. So the light is indicating a bunch of potentially different things. Is it time to go on at a certain maintenance time, like, you know, every 3,000 miles?
No, nothing like that.
Okay.
Yeah, there's maintenance reminder lights that are different, and those are on timed intervals. And but the check engine light or the service engine soon light, the malfunction indicator light, they all mean the same thing. A lot of times they have a little icon of an engine. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because the icon of the engine shows the old air filter style on top of the engine block, like an
really?
Old carburetor.
Yeah, the round thing.
Yeah, and it's just kind of a primitive looking icon. But yeah, it's all just one light. And there's, you know, thousands of different things that could be going on to cause that light to come on. Mm-hmm. there's just so many things happening every second you're driving your car. So it really does pay to get those checked out early. And oftentimes the advice given by an auto shop is, oh, you don't really need to do it, or, oh, it's just an oxygen sensor like Karen just mentioned. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just an oxygen sensor, that can affect 20% of your fuel economy. Mm-hmm. And over time, that's, you know, a lot of additional expense, not counting the fact that if your oxygen sensor is not working right, your catalytic converter might be having to work extra hard. And catalytic converters on modern cars are thousands of dollars. So you're just causing more damage by not keeping up on these things.
So in Karen's case, what is the fix for the burnt valve?
The fix,
is that a regrinding?
Yeah. So you would take the cylinder head or cylinder heads off if there's more than one, and you could fix just the one valve, or you could fix all the valves, and that's, you know, really up to the customer. A shop would give you an estimate for probably that option or the other option, you know, one or all.
All right, but this is a major engine overhaul.
It's not an engine overhaul, but it would be a top end.
All right, so you're taking the cylinder head off.
Yeah, the cylinder head would be part of the top end of an engine, and you would definitely want to address as much as you can at that time, because the act of taking off a cylinder head is generally, you know, 10 hours of labor.
Oh, man, that is a big deal. Okay. We're talking with Zach Edwards in this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel, nominally talking about winter car care, but whatever troubles your vehicle, we want to hear about it. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. We have some emails waiting as well at jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Kat in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Taking my call. Hi, Zach. Okay, so I have a 2000 Avalon. I'm her only owner, about 180,000 miles, and I drive this car. I adore her. I drive her like the old lady I am. So I have two things going. She recently went and got all the hoses changed. I've always told the people who work on the car that she needs to drive like she just came off their lot. Okay, so the last time I got her out, I think that the car is idling too low, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But the other thing that's going on is interesting is with the brakes, which I just got fixed in the summer. And usually I don't have to stop short. And so it took me a while to figure this out. But if I have to stop short, the brakes will go about halfway. You know, if you're just idling and you slowly put your foot down on the brake, there's a resistance, and then she'll drop to the floor. I can't get past that resistance, and I was standing on the brakes to get the car to stop in time. So going into the shop. But here's the interesting thing with the idle too low, maybe, because the car now is so quiet, but it goes, doom, doom, which just sounds like a hog. And I thought, okay, maybe too much fuel something, and so I took her out on an empty on-ramp and just gunned it, and it felt like a racehorse.
So it had really good power.
There's no warning lights. There's no overheating, uh-huh. And it's really fun to drive, but I'm nervous.
But it sounds chuggy, you're saying?
Very.
Okay. Sounds chuggy. And
the RPM is going below the number one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I've been putting the car in neutral at stop signs to keep it going.
Okay, so low RPM on one hand and then the brake pedal resistance on the other. Thanks for the call, Kat. You gave us a couple things to work with here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'll take off the air.
All right, take care.
I would say that the shop might definitely want to mention all of this to the shop. You know, these two things with your brakes and the idle could be related. You have a vacuum assist power brake system, and there's a large vacuum line connected to your brake booster, and what that does is it makes the pedal, if you've ever tried to stop a car that's not running,
yeah,
and you have to stand on the brake pedal, and
you do.
It's just rock hard, and it's very ineffective. It feels like you're only getting maybe 15% of your braking capacity if you've ever done that. And the reason it feels like that is because you have no vacuum assist. So the vacuum comes from the engine, the negative pressure an engine creates. And so when you're talking about feeling a really difficult brake pedal and not being able to get past it, I think is the term you said, it could be that you have a vacuum leak. So that's reducing the vacuum assist available to your brakes and also really throwing off your air-fuel ratio.
Which would account for the idle.
Which would account for the idle. So I think both of those things are, there's a strong chance that they're related. And if they're not related, sometimes on a higher mileage car, there's a throttle plate that needs to be cleaned. They just get kind of coked up with carbon, and that can also affect the idle quite a bit. But, you know, a lean mixture, you can feel an extra surge of power, and it sounds like you're really dialed in with your car. You're really well in tune with it, and you might be feeling that lean mixture in the form of extra performance when you really step on it. So good luck.
All right. That's a lot of fun stuff there, Kat. Appreciate that. So let's talk about RPMs, though, because I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, where normally should an engine be at idle if you're looking at the tachometer?
Yeah, I was trying to figure out if she was talking about it being below 1, meaning 1,000, mm-hmm. or 1 being 100. And that could definitely, again, cause the car to stall having that vacuum condition. But I would say, 800, 850 mm-hmm. is pretty normal. Some cars go down to 600, mm-hmm. But it definitely above 900 seems a little high. And if you're over 1,000, that's definitely too much. But the first start of the day, you'll notice that your RPMs are higher. The car revs itself up to kind of speed up that warm-up process.
Well, then when you're driving, too, I mean, we had a discussion recently about the standard shift cars, my wife and I, about what mm-hmm. the optimum idle is or what the optimum RPMs are. And I'm thinking, you know, because it looks like with the automatic cars, they tend to settle in about 2,000 RPM at regular speed.
At highway speed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ideally, if there's no load requirement, so if you're just on the flats, the lower the RPM, the better. That's going to maximize
your... definitely go for the overdrive if you got one.
Yep, that's going to maximize your fuel economy. And so that's why modern automatic transmissions, they're going for, you know, with the CVT.
Yeah, the constantly variable transmission.
Infinite amount of gear ratios there. Mm-hmm. And so they just constantly want to be able to have the least amount of revolutions per minute as possible without compromising the power and performance of the car. And so the minute the car senses a load, meaning a slight hill or a, like maybe you want to pass a semi truck, so it's going to know immediately that you're asking for more, and it's going to make that shift, which is going to raise the revolutions per minute.
Is there still a passing gear? And I'm using quote hands here.
Yeah.
On cars, you kick it into the thing and it goes, ee!
That's just downshifting is all that is, and it's really more of a strategy than an actual physical component.
Okay,
it's
so
just
us gramming the pedal to the floor.
We should call it passing mode instead of passing gear, and that's all it really is a strong downshift into the appropriate position so that the car can meet the required demand.
All right, we're talking to Zach Edwards on this month's edition of The Squeaky Wheel. A couple minutes left at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Linda in Medford wrote in and said, I have a question. I have a new car, and I read that it's very bad for a car to be only driven for very short trips. Can you explain why this is and what I can do if most of my driving is only short trips? Thanks from Linda in Medford.
Sure, that's a great question, and it's definitely not good, not ideal for a car to do only short trip driving, and this is right on line with what we've been talking about today with warm up. When you do a lot of short trip driving, your car might not ever come to full operating temperature, depending on what your definition of short trip driving is. But just around Ashland is too short usually. Medford, because it's a bigger area, if you just drive around Medford, maybe you're driving 10, 12 miles at a time. That's definitely better than only 5 miles or 3 miles at a time.
I'm laughing because you can see my car out there. I drive 5 miles.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what you can do to combat this, for one, you're going to need more frequent oil changes when you do that, because when your car's in enrichment mode, that extra fuel is going to inevitably end up in your oil. and that's going to degrade your oil faster than if you were doing the opposite of, say, all highway driving. Get your car up to temperature, get it into its stoichiometric ratio of 14.7 to 1, and then put 400 miles on it like that. That's awesome condition for a car. So in town, you might be running enriched, and then that extra fuel is going to end up in your oil, and then you're going to need to do your oil changes more regularly. So on a brand new car, they might be saying 5,000, 5,500 miles for oil changes. If I do only short trip driving, I would probably just change it every 3,000, and then make sure you use a really high quality oil. And the other thing you could do, take a trip, drive to Eugene, get on the highway.
Give Zach a ride.
Regular.
He goes up there a lot.
Get on the highway and drive the thing and try and just get it up to full operating temperature. But if you don't do that, again, a really high quality oil, make sure that your shop knows that you do mostly short trip driving, and they can help you, help advise you on the best things you can do to take care of that car.
So when you say high quality oil, what kind of stuff?
By brand
or by viscosity?
By brand, you know, there's certain brands out there that are known to be some of the best motor oil around, and there's other brands that are not, mm-hmm. and I'll try and just stay away from that, but
sure.
You can...
Bob's Motor Oil.
Yeah. There's just certain oils, and then there's actually certain style, maybe more so than weight, but there's high mileage oils out mm-hmm. there, there's synthetic oils, there's partially synthetic oils. There's just standard oil, and the main thing is to just, have that relationship with your shop. Make sure they know what type of driving you're doing, and make sure you trust them, and they should be able to give you the advice that you need catered to what you're doing.
Get to know your mechanic, which we try to do every month when we bring Zach Edwards in from Ashland Automotive. Always good to have you here for the Squeaky Wheel.
Thanks for having me.